Hello, and welcome to the Tuesday, February 20, 2024 episode of the Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. This is Craig W. Hurst, Emeritus Professor of Music, podcasting from my music bunker, along with my faithful canine companion, Carmel the Wonder Dog, to share with you my latest musical interests and discoveries. I claim no special inside information about the latest or greatest music, nor do I know everything there is to know about music. What I am is a lover of music. I enjoy several genres of music, and I share with you what has currently caught my interest, old, new, outdated, and everything in between. Even old music is brand new if you have never heard it before. The universe of music is a vast one to enjoy. From my discussions, you might find something new to you and of interest to expand your own musical universe. I currently receive no compensation or motivation of any kind from any recording label, recording artist, or estate of any performer or composer, dead and gone, to discuss their music and or recordings. Now with that out of the way, welcome to my musical universe. My guests today, that's right, I have two guests today, are Pete and Mara Kennedy, also known as the Kennedys. Songwriting duo Pete and Mara Kennedy make a strong return to the studio and stage after 3 years of weekly live-streamed lockdown-era concerts. They took the opportunity to explore classic songwriting in depth, performing over 1,000 songs during the pandemic. That vast overview strengthened and refined their own writing and laid the foundation for this new collection of original, socially conscious songs. After such a deep dive into American roots music, we felt like we had a new set of writing tools, says Mara. We were ready to create this body of work, and there's just so much to write about. During our 5-year hiatus from writing and recording, America changed in massive ways, divisive ways, that have shaken our whole foundation. That has to be addressed by creative artists, those of us who have a voice to speak for others. Our love of the great things about this country, things that are under threat, is the reason we decided to make Headwinds the title track of the album. Political and social headwinds are making it hard to get back home to our greatness as a nation. We want to push back in a positive way against those winds. In addition to singing and writing, Pete and Mara are multi-instrumentalists. The 13 songs are cast in a soundscape that draws from the classic canon of American roots, in keeping with the theme of getting back home as a nation. Acoustic and electric guitars, a vintage steel guitar, a gospel inflected piano organ mix, and even a slide ukulele all add colors to a song bag of sounds that have drawn us together during hard times. Pete and Mara believe that those sounds still have the power to pull us through again. Mara grew up in Syracuse, New York, while Pete grew up in Arlington, Virginia. The pair met in Austin, Texas, where Mara was based in the early 1990s, and they were subsequently based in the D.C. area as well as the East Village in New York City for many years, before settling in the Hudson Valley. The Kennedys began their writing and touring life 3 decades ago as members of Nancy Griffith's Blue Moon Orchestra, developing their own sound as a frequent support act on Nancy's tours across America, Ireland, Scotland, and England. Collaborations with Nancy continued, culminating in Pete and Mara producing their final album, Intersections. Along the way, they hosted a nationwide radio program, The Dharma Cafe, on Sirius XM, wrote and released 16 albums of original music, and have been core artists on folk radio, expanding their audience further with the inception of the AAA and Americana formats. It is my pleasure to welcome to my show, the Kennedys. Hello, Mara. Hello, Pete.
Hello. Hi, Professor.
Hello. It's really great to talk with you and have you as a guest on my show today. You know, one of the things, you're not the first duo or even husband and wife duo that I've had on my show. And so a big question that I always ask of people who work as a duo is, you know, is that beyond the obvious that the two of you perform as the Kennedys, what musical elements do each of you bring to the duo that makes the two of you musically unique from either Mara or Pete individually?
Good question. I'm primarily a singer and a songwriter. My musical background really focused on harmony singing. I loved listening to anything with harmonies. I was in choral group, but some of my favorite music growing up was music that had harmony, like the Hollies or the Everly Brothers, that kind of thing. And I also really liked melodic music, really a lot of pop music that was very melodic, had wide melodies. So that's where I come from musically.
And I would add that Maura's a really great guitarist too, but she has always focused on rhythm guitar. So she has perfect sense of tempo and dynamics and all those kind of things, as opposed to
excuse me, Pete. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm losing you on the audio.
Oh, maybe because the speaker here. What if I flipped it around this way? Because it's
the mic.
Yeah, the mic.
Check 1, 2, 3.
That's better.
Okay. Yeah, I would add that Maura is a terrific guitarist, too, and she has always focused on rhythm guitar.
Mm-hmm.
So our guitar styles mesh perfectly because I've always, of course, I play rhythm guitar, but I've always played lead guitar, too. And I'm primarily an instrumentalist, although I do singing in mostly in the background or duo style with Maura. But my background was freelancing for a couple of decades before we even met. So I had played with I'd played with symphonies when they needed a guitarist and played in the pit for Broadway type shows and done mm-hmm. a lot of things that were outside of the folk music realm. And so I could bring that just like Maura could bring her background at Ithaca College. We both had a lot of experience playing non-folk type music. And so mm-hmm. I think we can bring things that are of a little bit broader range than just than could be encompassed by just singer or songwriter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's evident in your new album, which we'll get to here in just a minute. But I agree, kind of just serendipitously, I just finished a book last night, entitled The Undertow by Charlotte. I can't think of his first name right now. He's a journalist. He teaches at Dartmouth. And the final chapter of the book was kind of a focus on Lee Hayes. And it brought to mind those great folk groups like the Almanac Singers and the Weavers and the Limelighters and I spent a good deal of time, not a lot, but some this morning listening to that music. And you're right, that vocal harmony is really something that's attractive to me and catching And it was really kind of a kind of an interesting music in its time period and its topical nature and so on. But I think that that's one of the great things about music today. In particular, I seem to be discovering that there is a lot of hybridization, cross-fertilization, I don't know exactly what you want to call it, into different musical styles. And I think that's, we've got a lot of different musicians with different backgrounds bringing a lot of different sounds to their music. So I think, Pete, your point is understood and well taken with your previous professional experience and then what you bring to the group and Mara with your vocals and the songs that you write. And speaking of which, let's get right to your new album, Headwinds, which I understand went to number one in October on the International Folk Alliance album chart. So congratulations to you on that.
Yeah, that's a first for us.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I'm curious to know, is the songwriting a collaborative effort, or did each of you contribute songs for that recording?
Some of them I wrote myself, some Pete wrote himself, and others we collaborated on.
Okay.
And we're not, and when we do collaborate, we're not like Burt Bacharach and Hal David, where one will write the music and the other will write the lyrics. We are more like a Lennon and McCartney, in the sense that one of us will start a song, and it could be anywhere from 10% to 90% finished when we give it to the other person, and they're kind of like the fixers, you know? So we write a lot like that, but that's not the only way we co-write. Sometimes Pete will give me a lyric and I'll put that to melody. Other times he'll come up with a cool chord progression. Because he's got a background in classical and jazz like you, he can come up with some really interesting chord changes, and then I can write a different kind of melody for myself to that. So we always approach songwriting in a different way.
Sounds to me like when you collaborate, it's like you're two halves of one brain, you know, in terms
yeah.
of...
Yeah, we figured that out early on.
Yeah, well, that's a great way to collaborate. You know, I never will forget, I can't even remember now how many years ago it's been, and I happened to be at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., and I had read something about they had a new Duke Ellington display at the Smithsonian, and so I went looking for it and finally got to where it was. Well, it was... All they had was one small case. And I asked one of the people working there, I says, is this all there is? And they said, no, it's just that there is so much stuff, you know, that we are, you know, it's taking us a while to process it all and to get it all in a proper display. But anyway, my point, one of the really cool things that was in that display case was a score for Take the A-Train by Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn. Well, you know that when you write musical notation, that is unique as handwriting, because the way one person writes musical notation is different the way someone else does, you know, just by hand. And what was cool to me was looking at that score, and you could see which parts Ellington had written and which parts Strayhorn had written. And I've always thought, been intrigued by, and it was very similar. It was almost like one was coming up with an antecedent phrase, the other a consequent phrase, or things that would complement each other's ideas. And I love that kind of creativity where, you know, people, you know, well, act like two halves of the same brain and kind of come up with things. That's interesting, a great way to work. I also understand too, that you're currently on an album release tour. That's what you've got down there in that warmer part of the country. You're down in Florida. How has the music from the new album been received so far on your tour?
It's been received really well. The comment that we get a lot at shows is that people really love the songwriting. And I have to credit that with the past 3 years during the pandemic, at the start of the pandemic and continuing now, we've been doing live streams. And at the very beginning of the pandemic, when we had lost our first weekend of gigs, we did a live stream. And we had never done one before. And so we told our audience at the end of the live stream, if you come, you know, if this pandemic thing lasts another week, we'll do it again next week. but we won't repeat any songs so that, you know, you have different music mm-hmm. to listen to. And then it kept going. So we started going through all of our repertoire. Mm-hmm. And between then and now, we've learned over 1,050 different songs.
Oh, my goodness.
And so learning songs by great songwriters, learning that many songs by great songwriters was like taking a master class in songwriting. And so I have to credit that experience with our songwriting on this album. I think that we really grew as songwriters from that experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it sounds sort of like you were kind of force-fed the Great American Songbook Plus. I mean, 1,000 yeah. songs. Oh my goodness, that's quite a repertoire to ingest. And I can imagine knowing the diversity that exists in songs. I mean, how that could have helped feed your imagination, feed your, you know, your muse, and help you with your creative, impetus for writing new material. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I think of a parallel. A class I used to teach at the university was called Creative Thinking and Problem Solving. And it was not a music-specific class at all. It was just something I volunteered to teach because it sounded interesting, and I've always been interested in the creative process and so on. And one of the exercises I used to have my students do was to invent something new based on, I would have about 36 different little items in a box. And they had to, without looking, reach in and take two items, taking those two existing items and figure out something new from that. And it was just an exercise in creative thinking. And I think, you know, what you're telling me about having to ingest all that music and then that probably is a way to really provide some fuel for your own, your inspiration is really kind of interesting to me. And that whole thing with live streams too, I don't know, every artist I've interviewed in the last couple of years, you know, went through that same kind of experience, you know, because we wanted to try to keep it alive some way. And how the heck did we ever know that COVID was going to last as long as it did? That's the thing. Well, that's good.
The other thing about, I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
Well, that's the other thing about, you asked how the songs are being received. And I think because we were writing during the pandemic, a lot of the issues that come up in the songs deal with the things that we've been dealing with the past few years.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think people were ready for songs that that were heavier on substance rather than style. Mm-hmm. And so we kept things simple, I think, production-wise, because we really wanted the lyrics to come across. We felt like there was a need there that we were trying to fill.
And also just touching on the subjects of, well, the pandemic, of course, isolation, the climate crisis, you know, political upheaval, all those things are represented on these new songs, in these new songs.
Yes. Well, you know, I hope I'm around 20 years from now when historians or sociologists or historical sociologists or historians interested will be discussing this time period that we've gone through with the pandemic and how it perhaps impacted our culture and our society, because I've got a gut feeling it did. But I haven't analyzed it enough to pinpoint, you know, specifics. But I think that as far as the people in the creative arts, it is has very much impacted all of us in one way or another in terms of subject matter, just the way that we have begun to express ourselves, even new technologies that have arisen from I think the isolation, you know, and looking for ways to get out. I mean, I will tell you, as I've mentioned this to a number of people, I started this podcast during COVID because I missed talking to other musicians.
Yeah.
and other people who love music like I love music. And I mean, my wife loves music and I love talking to my wife, but after a while, you know, you want to branch out a little bit. And so that's how I got the idea to do this, so that I could talk to people all around the world. And it's kind of grown into that kind of fun. Well, the other thing that I'm interested in is, you know, we know that when you have, well, the raw material, I guess we could call it that. And then once you get into the studio, things can change. And I want you to talk a little bit about the production for Headwinds, and how much did the production work shape or change the final product for the album from what you went in with the raw material of the songs that you had written?
I think those kind of changes happen on two different levels. They happen to individual songs in the process of working on the song. But then we still believe in albums rather than shuffle, play, Siri, play, this or that. We believe that an album is sort of like a novel with chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And there should be a flow. It's a big advantage if there is a flow to it. And so you might think a song is finished until you try to fit it into the puzzle of the 14 songs that's on the album. And then you realize the song belongs there, but not sounding the way it does. So that can happen. I wrote a song for the album called The Woods and the Wild, which I wrote. It's kind of a mid-tempo folk rock tune. That seemed like a good starting place because we have that's part of our baseline style. But then it was maybe too similar to other things feel-wise, and we felt like it should have its own place on the record. And I looked at the lyric one day and it occurred to me that it was a gospel song, but not a religious gospel song. It was celebrating nature.
Mm.
And I thought, well, heck, let's do it as a gospel song. So that totally changed the tempo. It changed the chords. All of a sudden it had sort of Ray Charles kind of chords. And and the orchestration too, because I decided to put piano and organ on it, which is a signature sound of that old time Mahalia Jackson style gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And also we turned up the bass louder on that one because that's typical of gospel too. And so then all of a sudden the song fit in the album, but it had its own identity too. So you kind of, listening to what you think is a complete album is a very revelatory thing, because then you'll hear the songs relating to each other rather than it being in isolation.
That one was really fun for me too, because I love that old gospel. I think my favorite gospel vocal group is Dorothy Love Coates and the Gospel Harmonettes. And they sing in really tight, high harmony, kind of answer to the lead. And so I got to experiment with that a little bit on that song too.
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting. Now I'm going to go back and listen with a different set of ears. I mean, knowing what you've just told me, because I've often thought that at least in more modern times, albums should be, you know, kind of telling a story. It's not like in the earliest days of rock and pop music that albums were just sort of a loose confederation of singles that maybe had already been released, that as rock listeners matured, we started, you know, kind of listening for that. And of course, then we had concept albums and the whole bit. And I know when I used to teach music appreciate, and I would talk to my students about 19th century song cycles, that composers would write a set of songs, but they would be around a particular theme. And I would say that's sort of like, you know, when you listen to, Dark Side of the Moon, or you listen to Sergeant Pepper, whatnot, you know, it's all these songs are kind of like the spokes on the wheel, and the hub is the central theme. And they would kind of, oh, you know. Now, of course, today, in today's parlance, that sort of his kind of thinking has gone away, because now we're back to, you know, downloading just a song or songs that one likes, instead of, you know, what we used to do in the old days was take the album out, laying on the floor of our bedroom, and reading the liner notes and the lyrics to the song underneath the black light. You know, now that kind of stuff. That's sort of it. But you make a really excellent point that I hadn't thought about, but I know I do all the time. When I put together a set list for a club date, you know, I want to put tunes in a particular order that I think are going to engage the audience, not have them go, oh, ho-hum, that was just like the last one. And you and all those things you talked about, Peter, right? The very things I think about, like tempo and the style of the underlying rhythm, those kinds of things. Yeah, I mean, that's ought to be very obvious, but I hadn't thought about that when I listened to your recording. So I'm going to go back to it with a different set of ears. That's
It's a lot
really.
like composition. You know, when you're composing, if you're composing concert music, you try to achieve a balance between familiarity and variety.
Exactly.
And we kind of do the same thing when we play live and when we put an album together. We try
Yeah.
to not let people get too comfortable, but not let them get disoriented either. Strike a balance right down the middle.
It's like you know, when I've talked, you know, having taught years and years of people who were lay people musically, and trying to explain to them like what makes a good jazz solo, you know, is a good balance between things that are familiar. Maybe you could think of that in terms of playing inside the chord changes versus things that push the envelope, playing outside the chord changes. You need a little bit of both, you know, like you say, familiarity, and then a little bit of unfamiliarity to keep your attention. So I think that's really interesting. Well,
Well put.
I'm sorry, did you want to add something? I didn't mean to
No, I just
interrupt.
said that's. I just said that's well put. I hadn't thought
Yeah.
about it that way, you know,
Yeah.
playing within the chords and without the chords, just the right balance to give the listener the familiarity and kind of stretch their minds a little.
Yeah, well, and you as a you know, Mara, as a singer, and I'm not pointing an accusative finger. I'm making an assumption. There's times probably when you mess with the phrasing a little bit. You
Sure, I
know,
mean,
I.
if you wanted to hear the album. The song's just like the album you go put on the album. But I do get a little freer with the melodies in concert.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when I play out, I don't, you know, I don't want to be a human jukebox. I like to change things up a little bit every time. And phrasing's one of those great things that you can stretch or you can push a little bit, and as long as the other people in the group don't freak out, it comes off pretty good. Well, that's super. That's super. Well, now I've got kind of what's a lot, maybe a long question, but again, it's one I'm really interested in knowing about your creative working process. So, all right, since you self-produced your album, how were you able to achieve the quote unquote objective view of your work that, say, an independent producer would have had, you know, someone on the outside, that other set of ears present in the studio who might critique what you're doing and offer suggestions on how to make it better? Now, I understand as a musician myself that we can look at something we just put down and say, we can do that better, or that was it. Now, what I'm getting at is the potential challenge of both of you looking objectively at a body of work you are creating and asking yourself, is that working? Is that what we want? Did you have those types of discussions when producing the album?
Well, we have co-produced all of our albums, so by now we're up to about
17 or
17
plus a
albums.
solo album too.
Yeah, we have that much experience, but I've also produced about 20 or 25 albums for other singer-songwriters, independent releases. So when I'm doing that, I'm just the producer. I'm not the artist. And mm-hmm. I've learned how to do that. I think you learn that like you can learn an instrument.
Okay.
You learn how to detach yourself enough to listen to the music without thinking just about your own part. You hear what you can somehow hear the final product in your mind. Mm-hmm. And I can apply that to our records too. And mm-hmm. so if it seems like it needs less of my whatever, some instrument that I played, it's totally instinctive for me to make that change. Mm-hmm. Whereas an artist would think.
Sorry, I'm gonna get rid of this. Oh. Hang on, I gotta.
Okay.
Okay. Sorry about that. Since we're using the phone.
That's all right.
An artist, when I've been producing other artists, a lot of times if they have no production experience at all, if you want to change something, they'll go, oh, but I put so much time into that. Or, oh, but I love that part. Or, oh, but a friend of mine, you know, my friend came in and played that part. But the producer has to have what you said, like that kind of looking down from above like a drone on the whole project.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we've been doing it for so long that we're able to do that.
Okay.
I've also read a number of accounts of people, great artists, talking about their producers. I just read recently where Johnny Smith said Teddy Reed, his producer, was great because he didn't do anything. The musicians, especially jazz musicians, I mean, they're going to play instinctively from within. And I know that John Hammond was famous for that too. He would sit and read the paper, and you know, Billie Holiday would sing a song, and then she'd say, "How's that sound?" And he'd look up and he'd go, "It's less than 2 minutes and 30 seconds, so it sounds good to me," because they had to fit everything on a 78.
Yeah, right.
So there's
right.
A certain kind of production that's not really doing anything. It's letting the artist.
Sure.
If they're very experienced, and we both are very experienced. So I think that we're able to do that.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. I mean, I think, yeah, when you were, you know, that's what I've gathered from other artists that I've talked to, that when the production team that they worked with were great because they knew when to say something, and more importantly, they knew when to keep their mouth shut.
Yeah,
and let the artist be themselves and how that came across. So
there are people who really need producers. I produced one guy, very nice guy, and he would sing. And then, you know, you want to listen back very carefully to the vocal. And when I would play the vocal back to listen to it, he would take out his harmonica and start playing. And I'd say,
wow.
Maybe you could play the harmonica after we listen to the playback. Because I'm trying to hear what you sang. You know, so
yeah.
People like that definitely need a producer to.
Yeah.
They don't have that overall vision of what's going on. They just know, like, what they're doing at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you. Yeah. Some people, you know, it's sort of like, you know, as an educator, you know, I've always had to kind of always play it from being aware of where the student is and what they need and what they don't need. Sometimes people need to make mistakes so they can learn, and you have to let them do that. Other times they need really more hands-on. No, this is what you do first. This is what you do second. This is where you go next, you know, this sort of thing. So there is an art unto itself there. I would say
that Maura produces her own vocals.
Uh-huh.
And really produces all the vocals on our record, which is the most important part.
Uh-huh.
So I wouldn't take undue credit as a producer.
I don't know if that's true.
Okay. All right. Well,
that's
a great answer. And I appreciate you sharing that with us. I'd like to ask you sort of an aesthetic question. You know, the ancient Greeks and Romans used to say that the purpose of tragedy in drama was to serve as an emotional cleansing, a catharsis for those who were there witnessing the drama. The songs that you write and sing, are they done with an idea of providing an emotional catharsis for yourself as reflections of personal experiences, or are they songs constructed to elicit a catharsis for others? And in either case, and as a follow-up to that, and in either case, what does your music cleanse emotionally from either yourself or others?
I think that I would be an example of the first kind of writing, and Pete would write from the second example.
Okay.
In other words, I tend to write about things that I feel strongly about, things that happen to me or things that I consider, whereas Pete will write to a specific form often.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example of the way I write. One of the songs on the album is called Late September Breeze, and that I was taking a walk, and it's a song about loss and longing, which we all went through during COVID, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was what I was, it was more about the subject that I was dealing with there, loss, longing. We had just recently lost a friend. Whereas Pete will say, yeah, I want to write a bluegrass song or
a gospel
song.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think in the, I think the strength of your music is that you start with something that you feel strongly about.
Yeah.
And then the song grows out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I think, the most powerful kind of songwriting. What I do is more formalistic.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a validity to that, too, I think. I've actually written two novels, so they're fiction. So I made up the characters. And when you make up the characters and the action, then you make up the feeling that the characters have that drives the action. You make up their motivations and how they feel about things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's okay to write songs based on that, too. Most of the American songbook songs by Cole Porter and Herman Hufeld, and they're not specifically writing their own feelings, mm-hmm. I don't think. I think that came about from blues music, Robert Johnson and people like that, who were being very, very self-expressive. You know, Robert Johnson and Beethoven would have got along great.
Mm-hmm.
And then Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, they were influenced by Lead Belly and Robert, that generation. And then they're the basis of the modern day folk music. So there's an expectation that you're writing about your own feelings. But I don't rise to that level, to use that commonly used phrase these days. Mm-hmm. I'm not a classic current day songwriter, because I do write, I think of the form and the overall, what the song is going to sound like later. And I write that. But, you know, you brought up the ancient Greeks, and I would say that Sophocles, when he wrote Oedipus Rex, I don't think he thought, now I need to find an actor who actually has killed his father and has a lame mm-hmm. foot and married his mother. You know, I think that the actors in Greece held that mask, the persona, in front of their face. Mm-hmm. And when they did that, then it was the mask speaking. Mm-hmm. The audience didn't think it was actually that person.
Mm-hmm.
That's different. That's a different tradition than folk music, where it's expected that you are expressing
mm-hmm.
yourself. So
mm-hmm.
That's why I don't fit solidly into the current folk music.
I a couple of examples that just came to my mind while you were speaking, Pete, was before we came on today, I was listening to some recordings by the Almanac Singers, and thinking about the union, pro-union songs that they wrote, Get Behind Thee Satan, and which side, let's see, whose side are you on? And that, and what they're, it's like, they're not talking about themselves. They're basically talking about a conceptual ideology and which, you know, are you? Are you with us or are you not with us? Or where are you on this particular subject? And I love that you raised Beethoven, not just because I love classical music, but mm-hmm. as you were speaking, I happened to think there was a motion picture that came out, oh my goodness, it might be almost 20 years ago, called The Immortal Beloved, which was about Beethoven. In fact, Gary Oldman plays Beethoven in the movie. And there's a scene in the film where Beethoven is asking Schindler, who's his manager slash attorney, whatever, you know, what is the purpose of music? And Schindler says, why, maestro, it's to uplift humankind. And Beethoven tells him, Schindler, you're a fool. So when you hear a march, you're not uplifted, you just march. When you hear a waltz, you're not uplifted, you just dance. He said the purpose of music is to put you in the mind of the composer at the moment they conceived the music. And after hearing that, when I would teach music appreciation, and I'd have the class listen to a piece, and the first question I'd say was, what kind of mood was Chopin in when he wrote that prelude? Mm-hmm. Was he happy? Was he sad? Had he just been jilted by George Sand, his girlfriend, or had he, you know, something, you know, that sort of thing, to kind of get in touch with whatever emotional content that he was having. And that's sort of like Mara with the personal expression. But I think, Pete, like you're talking about, you can create fictions that also express human interaction, human relationships, and human emotions. And then the audience or the reader can then pick it up from there and take it where they want to.
Yeah, it may not be drawn from my own experience, but it may relate to someone else's experience, a listener.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just like either one of us could write a story about going to the moon, even though neither one of us has ever been to the moon and likely will never go to the moon, but we can still have a concept of what it might have been like, or what it might be like.
We actually have one of those songs on our last album.
song about going to the moon.
Oh, I'll have
Jules Verne beat us all to that.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. I'll have to listen to some of the back recordings. Well, you know, I want to get to some of the specific songs on the album that stood out to me. Just when I did my initial cursory listening and I went, oh, or something that caught my ear, either or whatever. And the first one that caught my ear was Silence is a Warning.
Yes.
And that caught my ear because it has a very ominous undertone to it, suggesting that we should heed something that bad is coming. Would you comment on that, please?
Sure. We had been living in the East Village in New York City during the pandemic, at the beginning of the pandemic, about 2 months in, it was just really intense. In our neighborhood, we were kind of at the ground zero of, 800 people a day were dying in New York, and it was very cramped. It was hard to, you know, if you go out for to get supplies or whatever, it was hard to be isolated. So we moved up to the Hudson Valley about maybe around May, into my sister and brother-in-law's house. They had a whole floor that we rented from them, and we're still there, but we got really into hearing morning bird songs, which you don't really hear in New York City on the 15th floor. So every morning we would wake up to these birds singing, especially in May in the springtime. And one morning I was having my coffee and suddenly I noticed that all the birds had stopped singing. I'm like, what is going on? Something must be going on out there. And Pete looked out the window and saw this hawk in the tree right outside.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're always looking for metaphors, you know. The silence of all the birds was the warning that a hawk was there. But the metaphor there was, the climate crisis, the disappearance of bees, you know, that pollinate the plants that we get our food from, the political storm clouds, all that stuff. That's what the metaphor became. But that was the germination of that song.
Oh, I see. Well, then it's not too distant to say that, that silence is suggesting there that we should heed something might be coming. And
I kind of see
that sort of thing more and more, almost on a daily basis. And it's like this book I just finished reading last night is it's entitled The Undertow, the Slow Civil War. And the author of the book travels around the country interviewing various people, and it's really surprising to me how many people he interviewed thought that a civil war is coming. And and that's not something we look forward to, but it's no secret that we have a very culturally and politically divided country right now.
Dylan said that when Bob Dylan was learning how to write songs, he would go to the New York Public Library and read newspapers from the 1850s. So to be in the decade leading up to the Civil War. And he said that there is so much, there's a vibrant kind of power to the writing because of the sense of foreboding that everyone had. And he said you can feel that in the way that people wrote back then, even in the newspaper.
Wow.
So he said that informed his feeling that words should, carry power.
Wow. That's really eye-opening, very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Bob Dylan, I have to tell you that before I even read the lyrics or knew anything about the song, when I heard The Boy from the East River Shore, what caught my ear was the opening organ lick that I went, hey, that sounds just like Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. You know, that with the Leslie speaker and I guess that's what it is on the Hammond B3 sound. And then when I read the lyric sheet, I could see that there are interpolations from a Bob Dylan song. So please hip us to more about this song and its relationship to Bob Dylan.
Sure. Well, first I'll say that intro was the very last thing we put on it in homage to Bob Dylan as a kind of a nod, because it's like a Rolling Stone, maybe a little bit of Desolation Row. We wanted to acknowledge the Bob Dylan connection. But it started with, there's a song of Dylan's called Red River Shore. And the hook is The Girl from the Red River Shore. And it's a song I really love. There's a Jimmy LaFave version of it. That's my favorite version. Dylan, I don't think, ever put it on an official release. I think it might be on one of the bootleg records. But I always loved the concept. In the 50s, in country music in the 50s, there was the idea of an answer song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't God who made Honky Tonk Angels. And that was an answer song to
the wild side
of life. So I always liked that idea that one songwriter would write an answer song to another. And in Dylan's song, he puts this woman up on a pedestal, and it's a gorgeous, gorgeous song. So I got the idea for an answer song, and I just had the title, The Boy from the East River Shore, because we were living by the East River in New York. And like Pete, when he will write a song of fiction or write a book of fiction, I thought, okay, now I have a title, and I need to come up with a story. So I set it in New York City in the 70s. Son of immigrant parents who kind of get in with the wrong crowd, a gang, and there's a little bit of a Romeo and Juliet situation there. And it's all my own story, it's my own melody, but that hook line is very, very similar to Dylan's, the boy from the East River Shore, the girl from the Red River Shore. And I knew that it was my responsibility to clear that, make sure I wasn't infringing on any rights and or get the right permissions or share the writing and publishing. So I got a hold of Dylan's people, and it took a long time. I didn't hear back from them for months, and I was afraid I was gonna have to leave the song off the album because I just didn't wanna put it out until I had especially the powerful publisher like his. But about a month before we went to press, they got back to us and said they liked the song. They gave us permission, and that the wording that you see in the liner mm-hmm. notes that we used interpolation, that was the wording that they gave us.
Oh, okay.
So we got their blessing, and as I understand it, Dylan himself had to listen to my song and approve it or not. So I feel very proud about that.
Wow.
He dug it.
That is very cool that he liked it. That's,
Yeah.
I mean.
I'm assuming he never called me or anything, but
Oh,
I'm
well.
assuming if he didn't like it, he wouldn't have let me get away with putting
Probably.
it on a record.
Sure. Well, that's awesome, that connection. And I'm happy to know that I made that connection as well, even
Yeah.
not having read it. Of course, being very familiar with like Rolling Stone, I mean, that's what made me kind of go, oh, that's a lot like that. Well, I want to
He put that
really,
intro on it
yeah.
after the whole song was recorded. Pete said, "Oh, let's do this intro."
Well, I think
Oh.
your ear is tuned to musical themes as well as lyrical ones. And what I was thinking in the instrumentation was Dylan in 1966 when he toured with the band backing him up, or most of them anyway, not all of them. And so I thought, well, what would Garth Hudson play on the organ? What would Richard Manuel be playing on the piano? And especially with the guitar solo, what kind of tone would Robbie Robertson have used on his Telecaster in 1966? And so there's a lot of little musical references to Bob Dylan, as well as the melodic ones.
That is now that's really interesting because now I'll listen to it a whole different way. It's almost like you took a musical snapshot of that time period, trying to recreate, some of those sounds as well. That's really fascinating. Well, I want to shift gears because I also loved the song Tangerine. And I love Tangerine
Huge.
because it is just an upbeat, happy, reaffirming piece of music. And so anyway, now also going back to your earlier discussion about telling a story. So is Tangerine's function to be sort of an emotional sorbet among the songs of a more serious topical nature?
I love that you use sorbet. But I would say it's not topical, it's tropical.
Tropical, yes.
That was just one of those things. E.L. Doctorow, we knew him, and he once told us, "Be the person on whom nothing is lost." Is that what? And so we were driving down to Florida to do our southern gigs a couple years back. And as soon as we cross the border, we buy fruit at one of those highway fruit stands. And we had driven all the way down to the very tip of Florida before heading out on the Keys, and checked into a motel we'd checked into many, many times. But since the last time we had stayed there, it had really taken a dive. It was not clean. It was noisy, and I couldn't sleep. And so I found myself 4 in the morning, pacing in this dark room, just waiting for sunrise so we could get out of there. And I looked over at the bag of tangerines that was sitting on our dresser, and I was just focused on a tangerine. I thought, oh, I'll write a song for a tangerine. What would that be? And I thought of, is it Carmen Miranda with the fruit on her head? I thought it should have that kind of beat, and it should be silly, and the lyrics should be, not too complicated, and yet very structured, like the Great American Songbook kind of stuff. So I had a lot of fun writing that song, and it got us to sunrise, and we got out of that stinky motel. So, but I always say to people, you might think that this is a metaphor for something, because a lot of our songs have metaphors, but indeed, it's just a love song to a piece of fruit.
About a
That's
tan about a piece of fruit. Okay.
it.
Well, that's good. I
Sorry.
mean, I just loved the song as because it's very kind of upbeat nature. And right along with that is your song Sacramento, which I loved because it's just this wonderful country Western sort of dance tune, and the lyrics are just fun. And I've got to have you tell us about the bootleg tiki lounge and what that was and all about.
That's a gig out in near it, it's in Sacramento, but it's actually in a backyard, a large
Oh.
enough backyard to accommodate an audience,
And
and there's a
stage
stage
and a
and
tiki
some
bar.
lights, and there is a tiki bar. And it's a wonderful place to play music and to hear music, because you're playing outdoors, and you know, when the weather is good, it's just a magical kind of thing. And also the woman who runs it is just one of these great souls who does it totally purely for the love. Mm-hmm. And it's a labor of love for her. So we thought there should be a kind of a tribute to her. And once again, I did the instrumentation in a certain style. I wanted it to be Western swing, mm-hmm. because that's the music that in the Central Valley of California and up in the gold mining region, that's the music that people danced to back in the 30s and 40s into the 1950s, because they had come from Arkansas and Oklahoma and Texas. They were the Okies. So mm-hmm. I thought, yeah, let's put the music of the people that migrated from the Dust Bowl to California as the setting for this lyric.
So you played the lap steel.
Yeah, some steel guitar and stuff like that on there.
Very cool. You know, well, so well, I liked it because I love a really good country boot scooter. You know, it's yeah, those are really some great kind of feeling songs. And
Western swing music also was basically jazz with country mm-hmm. instruments. If you really delve into it, the players were they could have gone to New York and you know, taken off their cowboy hats and put mm-hmm. on suits and play jazz.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Bob Wills, he employed some very fine musicians during his time. And Martin Brown, who was the granddaddy of Western swing, supposedly. But that was an interesting time, interesting music. But I really like the song, and then that whole reference to the bootleg tiki lounge. I thought, I got to find out about that. Well, we've only scratched the surface of the songs on the album. There's 9 more songs that we haven't talked about. Are there others that you would like to highlight for my listeners that we haven't talked about?
Well, sure. We're sitting here talking to you from our hotel in Marathon Key in the Florida Keys. It's a hotel that we always stay at. We love it. They provide bicycles that we can ride for free. And the song Headwinds was written, most of the song I wrote on one of the bicycles that we borrowed mm-hmm. from this motel. And we were bicycling out from Marathon out to Pigeon Key, which is a little historic village that is only connected to land by a portion of the Flagler Railroad system that got washed out in the hurricane of 1935. And so they made that one little 2-mile stretch over the ocean from Marathon out to Pigeon Key. They made that a hike and bike trail. So you can't drive out there. And a couple years ago, we borrowed the bicycles. We rode out and packed a lunch, and sat by the water out on Pigeon Key. And when we were ready, we biked back to the hotel. And at about halfway back, I was really working that bicycle. I realized that we had a tailwind with us on the way out, mm-hmm. but a real strong headwind on the way back. And I came up with a line. I mean, I wasn't even thinking of songwriting. I thought, boy, headwinds make it hard to get back home. And that was a light bulb moment for me. That's a really good hook. And so that's when I, you know, you get the hook, then you have to put the song, construct the song around it. And when I got that line, I thought of Tammy Wynette. I love Tammy Wynette songs. Mm-hmm. You know, the simplicity of them, the big amount of space between phrases, and that little catch in her voice and everything. And I wanted to write a Tammy Wynette song. So that's what Headwinds is.
Okay.
But we chose it as the title track for the album, though, because it kind of represents all these things that we've all collectively been going through in the past, you know, 3+ years that I mentioned before: the pandemic, isolation, climate crisis, global warming, the mm-hmm. political upheaval. All these things are the headwinds that we're all facing as a society, trying to get back to some sense of normalcy. So That's why we chose that particular song as the title track.
I see that. I can see that. And based on what you've said earlier about constructing an album like you would construct a novel, I'm having a real epiphany here about your music. I need to go back and listen now again and, kind of take a deeper dive, knowing what I know, which is just fascinating. Well, I'm going to ask, it's probably an obvious question, but are you currently or are you constantly writing new material? And can you offer a sneak peek of what audiences might hear new from you?
Well, the album Headwinds is so new that we're really focusing on, we're touring all over the place. Starting in August, okay. A week before the record came out, we've been on the road and just playing our new songs for people all over the U.S. So we're really focused on that right now. But we have most of February off. And so we're going to be kind of decompressing a little bit. And that's when songs tend to come, at least to me. I like to not have too much going on. That way, if I'm taking a walk or riding a bike or driving a car, everything else sort of goes away. Well, not when I'm driving a car. I have to pay attention to the road.
When you're riding in the car.
But I tend to go into kind of a meditative state when I write. I'll focus on one thing or one concept. And I think we'll have plenty of time to do that in February.
Sure. Sure. I understand. You need that distraction of your conscious mind so the subconscious can come out and, do the creative work,
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You'd be surprised, or maybe you wouldn't be, how many songwriters I've interviewed that have told me that they get their inspiration while they're in the car. And they're
we
in the car.
Spend a lot of time in the car.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, while you're driving, because that's something that you still have to be conscious to do, yet while you're consciously focusing on making sure you don't go off the road, your subconscious has a tendency to wander a bit, I guess. It's either in the car or in the shower. Is the ones that I probably hear most often. The most unique one is a songwriter that told me that she gets her ideas while she's vacuuming.
that is unique, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she's probably got a rhythm going, back
yep.
and forth, up and down.
Yeah, yeah.
Mozart would write between pool, he played pool, whatever pool was, billiards back then. And he would write, he had a stand-up desk by the pool table, and he'd take a shot, then he'd go over and write, come back, take another shot. So maybe the pool game kind of put his mind on that creative plane.
I just read that Dan Penn and Chip Moran wrote Dark End of the Street in Las Vegas. They'd been playing the table, craps or blackjack or something for a while, and they wanted to take a half an hour and write a song. So they went up to a room and cranked that one out and then went back to gambling.
Oh man, there's probably a bunch of stories like that, and it's sort of like, you never know when your muse is going to spew and it just, when it happens, it happens. Well, so you've got February coming up, a chance to relax, kind of let things flow. Are you thinking at all about your next recording, or is that something you're also kind of putting on hold while promoting Headwinds?
Well, when we make a record, we never start with an idea of let's make a record. We start with a song first.
Okay.
And see what we're writing. And I think with Headwinds, that's what happened. We had written these songs and we started to see a pattern. There's a lot of subject matter related to the climate crisis. The sky doesn't look right. Silence is a warning. Little Green Bottles even has got an ecological bent to it.
Yeah.
And then we saw an album kind of organically come together. That's how we usually approach each album.
Okay.
Let the songs tell us what it's going to be.
Okay. Well, I think that's, everybody's different the way they do things. And that's certainly a very, reliable way to do it. Make sure you got the songs first and then put it together. I only have a couple more questions for you. One is probably one that a lot of the people I interview say is a challenging one to answer, but excuse me. What have been some of your most memorable experiences of your musical career?
I can tell you probably one of my earliest memorable musical experiences was before I was even performing, but I was working in a record store back when they sold records and cassettes. Mm-hmm. And I remember this little Englishman came in and he asked me where the Kinks cassettes were. And I said, oh, I knew the Kinks music really well. And I said, here you go. And he says, yeah, I'm going to be playing bass with them tonight and I don't know what to play. And I said, well, I saw them last week here. I can give you all the cassettes you want that mm-hmm. are going to be in the set. So I kind of prepped Jim Rodford for his first gigs with the Kinks. That was an early one. And my latest greatest musical memory happened just a couple weeks ago, and I got to sing Teach Your Children with Graham Nash.
Oh my.
So that was an amazing experience. And then in between all that were all the years where we toured, wrote, recorded, collaborated with Nancy Griffith. She was always a big influence on me and on both of us.
Mm-hmm. You know, until you just mentioned, I know it's in your bio and I'd forgotten that you guys had played with Nancy Griffith. Love It, The Five and Dime is still one of my favorite songs of hers. I love that song. And I used to love, listening to her music. And when I used to live in Texas, and I was there for 15 years, and the KERA, the public radio station out of Dallas, used to always play a lot of folk Americana, music, played a lot of Nancy Griffith and John Gorka, and then they would also broadcast live from the Kerrville Folk Festival. Nancy Griffith, I loved her music. So that's really great. Yeah, that must have been super. Well, Pete, how about you? What's your greatest memory or greatest experience?
Well, I would have to have a whole list too, like Morris. I would try to narrow it down. I think as a guitarist, being able to learn from people who are really master musicians like Joe Pass and Johnny Smith, Charlie Bird, Chet Atkins, Doc Watson. I was able to sit down with all of those people and learn from them, and then be able to go out as a freelancer and play. I did a gig with Leonard Bernstein and one with Aaron Copland and things with the National Symphony and that kind of thing. And freelancing, there was one gig that was, I was just in the orchestra, not featured at all, just playing guitar, reading my charts. The singers singing all at the same time were Dionne Warwick, Luther Vandross, Stevie Wonder, and Elton John, and Gladys Knight.
Wow.
And the piano player was Burt Bacharach.
Oh my, there's a mighty handful.
Yeah, right. And just to be a small part of the orchestra while that was going on was just so uplifting, because they were actual geniuses on the stage. But then I played with a folk songwriter named Kate Wolfe, and I felt that a couple of acoustic guitars and someone singing really, really great songs was actually just as powerful as anything else I had ever done.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there was 100 people in the symphony, I thought there was an equal or even greater emotional payoff to what Kate Wolfe was doing. And that led to playing with Nancy Griffith. And then that led to right into playing with Maura. And so I think these gigs that I've done with these great songwriters are in every way equal to playing, with the bigger celebrities, because this kind of music distills the most meaningful parts of music down into one powerhouse of emotional payoff.
Yeah.
So that's really something to be part of.
Pete wrote a memoir several years ago where he talks about all the people that he played with and learned from. And I think my favorite story of yours is when that show you were talking about, mm-hmm. when the union took a break, but you stayed out to look over your charts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was looking at my charts looking for, you know how you look for the hard parts so you mm-hmm. can lay for them when you have to, the baton goes down. And while I was on the stage, it was at the Kennedy Center, without seeing me, Burt Bacharach and Dionne Warwick came out and they sat at the piano. He sat at the piano about 10 feet away and she stood next to him and they quietly rehearsed all those great songs, you know, we'll walk on by and do, mm-hmm. you know, the way to San Jose. And they never saw me. So if they saw me, I would have had to, you know, they would have shooed me out of there.
Sure.
And I just sat there, I didn't breathe for about 20 minutes while they did this rehearsal. And so that kind of thing, you feel like you get pulled in a good direction. Mm-hmm. You know, you may never be Burt Bacharach or Dionne Warwick, but being able to actually be around them for a short time, you get a sense of what good really means, how good people really are.
Exactly.
So it gives you something to aspire to and it keeps you going. I think that's why after playing for 50 years, I'm still just as much a student as I was when mm-hmm. I first started out. I still feel like a beginner because I know how much better the great stuff really is.
Sure, sure. I'm right there with you. You know, that's the great thing about a growth mindset is there's always something we've got to learn and there's always something or someone to aspire to. And I guess that's a great thing to keep us going. I keep trying to convince me.
Jazz, any kind of music, jazz, it's obviously true too. You know, you have iconic people who are icons because they really were geniuses. And
yeah.
You can kind of always try to aspire to better yourself.
Yeah. Well, those are some awesome stories. Thanks, guys. I try to be very thorough in what I ask guests because I like to try to make sure they get to talk about everything they want to talk about. But I know I'm not perfect. And so I'm going to ask, is there anything else you would like to add or tell my audience that I have not asked you about?
Well, Pete just, I'll go back. At the beginning of the pandemic, you know, some people were making sourdough bread and others were, planting gardens and stuff. Pete decided he was going to write his first book of fiction. And it's kind of a magical realism story, adventure, intrigue story. And so it was a one-off book, but then people really liked the characters and asked for more stories. So he just released what is now book two of the Floodwood Chronicles. And so he's on his second book of fiction. So that's very exciting.
It's exciting.
I love reading fiction. So I really enjoy that. And that's just out now.
Actually, the heroine is a college professor. So you and your wife might.
There you go. There you go. All right. Well, that sounds wonderful that you've got the literary career going along with your musical career. That's super. Well, Mara and Pete, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with me today. It's been a lot of fun, and I want to wish you all the best with what I'm sure is going to be a continued successful musical future.
Well, thank you, Craig. We really enjoyed talking. It's great to interview with another musician because we can speak the same language.
Yeah, great questions. Really.
Well, good. Well, I, you know, like I told you earlier, I started doing this because I like talking to other music people too, and it's been really great. So you guys have a great rest of the day and enjoy Florida.
All right. The sun just came out, so.
Oh, well, I'm still looking for it up here.
we'll try and send some.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you guys have a great day.
You too. Thanks. Take care.
Bye. My composer of the week is French composer, performer, and theorist Tristan Murail. Murail was born in Le Havre, March 11th, 1947. He studied economics and Arabic at the École des Hautes Études before entering the Paris Conservatoire to attend Messiaen's composition class from 1967 to 1972. That year, he was resident at the Via Medici in Rome, where he remained until 1974. In 1973, he founded the Groupe d'Itinéraire, which quickly established itself as the leading new music ensemble in France throughout the 1970s and 1980s. In addition to composing a number of his most significant scores for the group, Mérard also participated in it as a performer on electronic keyboard instruments such as the synthesizer and the Ondes Montonnantes. He is a well-known virtuoso of the latter instrument and has made many appearances as soloist in such works as Messiaen's Turangalila Symphony, which he has recorded twice, and Trois Petites Liturgies. Between 1987 and 1996, he taught computer-assisted composition at the Paris Conservatoire and at IRCAM, during which time he also had a number of successful private composition pupils, including Marc-André d'Albeville and Philippe Hurel. In 1997, he moved to the United States to become professor of composition at Columbia University in New York City. Mérard belongs to the generation of French composers after Boulez, and his development may be seen to some extent as a reaction against the serial-dominated techniques prevalent until the mid-1970s. Stimulated by Messiaen's research into resonance and his refinement of instrumental timbre, Mérard used acoustics and the study of the perception of sound as the starting point for a new musical aesthetic, which has since become known as spectral music. In Mérard's case, the first works to reflect this development were Sables for orchestra, composed in 1974, and Mémoire et Rougeon for horn and nine instruments from 1976. In both these pieces, the musical structure is defined by drifting between moments of pure consonants derived from the natural overtone series and passages of extreme dissonance, analogous to so-called white noise. In Sables, the transformations between these two states are effected very smoothly in a continuous orchestral texture, which evolves without interruption or punctuation for nearly 20 minutes. In Mémoire et Rougeon, the structure and texture are derived from an instrumental simulation of a device found in analog electronic studios of the time called a re-injection loop, in which an instrumental sound is recorded and passed across multiple tape heads while new sounds are fed in. The ensemble, imitating everything the horn plays, simulates the canonic and echoing effects of this process, as well as the inevitable deterioration and deformation of the sounds toward pure noise, which results from the tape being repeatedly copied. Mérard developed these processes of transformation further in two other concertante works from the late 1970s, Ethers, 1978, for flute and five instruments, and L'écran de l'espace, 1979, for ring-modulated Ondes Montonnantes and small orchestra. In the later 1970s, Mérard began using other techniques from electronics to derive his forms and harmonic structures. Principal among these were the related techniques of ring and frequency modulation, both of which engender complex timbres derived from summation and difference tones. This allows for a careful control of the degree of inharmonicity, that is, the degree of deviation from the natural overtone series. The first large-scale pieces written using these techniques were Treize Couleurs du Soleil Couchant from 1979 and Gondwana from 1980. In the former, pairs of pitches forming a variety of intervals are used to generate the harmony for each section. It is interesting to compare the two versions of the work because the second uses actual electronic ring modulation to clarify and confirm the instrumental harmonies derived from this procedure. In Gondwana, Murat's most ambitious piece from this time, every aspect of the work, whether harmonic, textural, or formal, is derived from frequency modulation processes to form a large-scale symphonic canvas of almost symphonic breadth. There is a particular emphasis on the bell-like timbres for which frequency modulation is renowned in computer music. In 1980, Murat attended the computer music courses at IRCAM, where he deepened his knowledge of computer programming and software. The outcome was Desintegration, 1982 to 1983, for 15 instruments and computer-generated tape, in which Murat used computer analyses of instrumental spectra to generate both the harmonic syntax and the form. This work is the first in Murat's mature output to incorporate silences and breaks in continuity, punctuating or disrupting the transformations. The orchestral works, Zilliges from 1985 and Time and Again, 1985, make further inroads into the realms of discontinuity and abbreviated processes in structures replete with flashbacks, premonitions, loops of time, as the composer has commented. Time and Again also confronts Murat's orchestrally simulated frequency modulation harmony with its computer model, as the work includes an important part for the DX7 synthesizer. As with Desintegrations, the precision of Murat's spectral techniques results in an exact fusion of electronic and instrumental sounds. With Allegories of 1989, Murat turned his attention away from spectra as such and towards working with what he calls complex objects. In Allegories, the object is the initial gesture of rise and fall, which is subjected to all manner of enlargements, expansions, contractions, and paraphrases across a variety of spectra throughout the piece. In L'Esprit des Dents of 1996, the spectra of instruments from folk and religious traditions, such as Jews' harps or Tibetan trumpets, were analyzed and provided the raw material for another mixed canvas blending electronic and instrumental sounds. Murat's most recent orchestral piece, Partage des Eaux, of 1997, derives all of its materials and forms from a sampled extract of the tide receding on a beach. All of these works have a more elusive and ambiguous approach to form than Murat's earlier music, involving multiple layers of spectral processes rather than a single unidirectional one. In the early 1990s, in order to aid composing with these multidimensional objects and processes, Murat developed at IRCAM a sophisticated software package for composers entitled Patchwork, which he has used to compose much of his subsequent work. His remarkable ear for sonority and harmonic refinement, however, has remained his most noticeable stylistic trait, regardless of the technology involved. The All Music Guide lists 46 recordings of Murat's compositions. In my show notes is a link to a YouTube video recording of Murat's Desintegration. That wraps episode number 177. My show notes, along with links to artist websites, recording label websites, YouTube videos of artist performances, are all posted on my Facebook page, The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Coming up next week, I'll be interviewing Nashville-based genre-hopping singer-songwriter Nina DeVitri. We will talk about her latest album, What You Feel Is Real, as well as have an excellent discussion about musical genres and drawing upon elements of those genres in her musical expressions. Other upcoming interviews include New York City-based percussionist and composer Jake Richter and Melbourne, Australia-based jazz saxophonist Anton Dileka. So, don't touch that dial and stay tuned. If you have questions, comments, or a suggestion of an artist, composer, or musical style for me to consider, you may email me at hurstc@uwm.edu. So until next time, this is Professor Craig W. Hurst and Carmel the Wonder Dog signing off from The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Have a great day.